You are listening to Anti-Institutional Extremism, Causes and Responses, a podcast series from the International Center for Counterterrorism. In our third podcast series, we discuss the issue of anti-institutional extremism. This series considers, what is anti-institutional extremism? What does anti-institutional extremism look like in North America and Europe today, and how can it be addressed?
Hello, I'm Joanna Cook, Editor-in-Chief at ICCT. Welcome to the show. In this series, we've looked at academic approaches to understanding anti-institutional extremism and also describing what this looks like in North America and Europe. In our last episode, we spoke with the head of the Dutch Intelligence and Security Service, Mr. Erik Akkerboom, about anti-institutional extremism and to hear about how they view and are responding to this issue. Today, in the final episode of our series, we will have the chance to discuss practically how the US government assesses and approaches the issue of anti-institutional extremism from the perspective of the State Department. And with us today, we have the pleasure of hosting Mr. Ian Moss. Mr. Ian Moss is the Deputy Coordinator for the Bureau of Counterterrorism, overseeing countering violent extremism and terrorist detentions. He's responsible for developing and implementing a range of policies to counter racially or ethnically motivated violent extremism, and to combat terrorist use of the internet, and to prevent terrorist recruitment and radicalization to violence. Additionally, Ian is responsible for managing diplomatic efforts associated with foreign transfers of custody, the detention and repatriation of terrorists and terrorism suspects, and initiatives to rehabilitate and reintegrate former extremists. Prior to his appointment, Mr. Moss served at the Department of Defense, where he practiced law in the military commissions at Guantanamo as an attorney with the Military Commissions Defense Organization. Mr. Moss, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Joanna. I appreciate it.
Let's just dive right into it here. We're dealing with an increasingly complicated world today. How do you describe this threat landscape? And where does anti-institutional extremism fit into this?
I think kind of as you put your finger on it, the situation at current is quite complicated. The types of threats that we face are diverse. They borrow from one another, at least with respect to the actors that are determined to sow discord within our society, to bring about some desired political change or even demographic change. We see this across the West. We see this elsewhere in the world, too, to include Central and Eastern Europe and even parts of Asia. So the threats that we're facing, one, are multifaceted. They are certainly more decentralized, I think, than what we have been accustomed to dealing with over the past two decades as a general matter. And part of the reason for that is the actors have seen how successful, for example, our strategies have been in terms of countering threats by large global or large organizations with global aspirations. So the Al-Qaeda's, the ISIS's were by all accounts pretty top down. They were had very centralized command structures in many ways, but that is not necessarily an attribute that we see with respect to anti-institutionalists, the conspiracy theorists, and what we call RIMVs, or racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, which I should say for the purposes of this conversation, the U.S. government uses as an umbrella term that really pulls in a variety of different actors and folks with different motivations, but are typically found on at the extreme right wing and at times on the extreme left of the political spectrum.
Yeah, you did discuss anti-government extremism in particular at a recent ICT annual conference where you did a keynote. And here you were mentioning that, or you were discussing the idea that that anti-institutional extremism does sit under that same umbrella alongside racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism. Can you maybe expand on this a little bit further? How exactly does that particular phenomenon fit under this umbrella of racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism?
I think what we've seen, and we draw from our experience domestically, and it's certainly something we've seen play out on the international stage, which is, of course, what our primary focus is at the State Department. But a number of these organizations and actors, first of all, they're competing for adherence from generally the same pool of individuals. And one tack that they take is to identify individuals with particular grievances and draw associations between the grievance that an individual, you know, their target may feel and whatever their, kind of principal objective is, with regard to, you know, their particular strain of extremism. So it's kind of a, they will hook you in and then expand, your mind, so to speak, in an effort to grow their ranks. But we've seen, interestingly, for example, in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic, there were significant, relationships between, say, conspiracy theorists, on the one hand, with respect to, information about the pandemic, and individuals that look to disrupt the kind of natural order within our democratic societies. So, they found opportunities to marry, their efforts. So, folks who were naturally skeptical, say of health officials, then were, courted by individuals that and actors who sought to dismantle institutions. And so the perspective of the, for example, anti-vaxxers fit very nicely with, the objectives of the actors who were, or who continue to be, quite opposed to our governmental institutions like the institutes of health in various places. So they oftentimes would draft on, other sets of grievances and concerns, show up at protests, and then associate themselves, so to speak, with other groups.
One of the consistent themes that's come through in this series is our debates about how to define or describe this phenomenon, and whether an academic perspective or a government perspective, we have seen quite a bit of distinction in terms of how we understand and actually define or describe what it is we're looking at with anti-institutionalism. In the U.S. government, has there been any debate about how to define or describe this particular phenomenon?
Look, I think that the fact that there is an ongoing debate and a lack of consistent definitions, I think evidences the fact that we are still trying to untangle and understand what this looks like in various contexts. So it may look slightly different in the U.S. versus in the Netherlands or in Belgium. But we've certainly, there's a significant domestic component here in the United States. There are any number of, there are just a very large number of ongoing prosecutions, largely in the context of the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol, which certainly involved a number of actors and individuals that would fall into the categories about which, you know, we're discussing today. So there's been a serious and coordinated effort within local law enforcement to prosecute where possible, and understand, how domestic groups are connected. Where we come in, is at the State Department is, trying to understand and coordinate with partners and allies, where we see connections, transnational connections between groups. Part of what has enabled and facilitated these groups and to engage in really concerning activity is their ability to communicate with one another in a way in 2023 or 2024 presents a whole lot of opportunity. It's not something that was easily done, say, 50 years ago. The internet and the online space has made this much, much more possible. So we know that those transnational connections exist. We know that through those transnational lines of communication, these groups share tactics, they share ideas, they recruit, they promote kinship among the various groups. They posit that they are, in a sense, fighting the same battles, and that success in any front is dependent upon success in on the fronts in other governments. So, you know, the United States, to be honest, you know, has a unique responsibility here. Unfortunate share of concerning ideas and information emanates from the U.S. So that in part is animating our very concerted effort with partners and allies to try to make sure that we have mechanisms and frameworks in place to address the transnational aspects of, you know, of RIMVI, of racially or ethnically motivated violent extremism, and all of its offshoots.
You did mention earlier that it is very unique to each specific context, and that certainly is true. And I wonder, based on your comments there, when you say that a lot of this is emanating from the U.S., what would you say specifically is emanating from the U.S. that might be unique to that particular context?
Well, white identity terrorism is top of mind. Certainly, white supremacy and white identity terrorism is not germane necessarily solely to the United States, but there has been, frankly, a history here in this country, for certain reasons, some structural reasons. There have been, at times, environments that have been more permissive than others, that have allowed that ideology to grow. We have seen over the past, several years, however, that some of this, much more of this has come to the surface. and folks have taken advantage of, the ability to espouse ideas. I mean, we take very seriously our freedom of expression. It is, you know, well within any individual's right to hold and express whatever their views are. Where the line is, however, is when those expressions, are then manifest, in violence. And that is something that we have seen domestically, and it's something that we see abroad. But given the success of certain horrible violent actors in this country that engaged in racially motivated acts and attacks, they are seen by individuals outside of this country as inspiration, and vice versa. So you have Dylann Roof, for instance, in Charleston, South Carolina, that killed 9 parishioners at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, who had drawn inspiration from violent extremists that have committed massive violent acts in other parts of the world, say Hans Breivik, or Brenton Tarrant in New Zealand. I mean, so they see one another, they are inspired by one another, and they kind of view they view themselves as part of an ongoing ongoing fight, so to speak.
And you mentioned earlier as well that one of the key focus of your particular department is to look at those links, those transnational links between specific groups and actors. And from your perspective, you've just mentioned links between individuals and inspiration between individuals, but have you also observed links between specific groups, or are these would we describe these as broader loose networks?
I think as a general matter, we would describe them as, I think, broader loose networks. Again, going back to a point that I made at the top, these actors know that you get too big, then you will be on the radar in a much more pronounced way. And our governments have done a pretty decent job at taking down larger organizations. So there are lots of different kind of tactics that these organizations take. I mean, they conceal their activities through, for example, active clubs. There's one of our colleagues, Alexander Richmond, just did a pretty substantive research project on active clubs in Europe and in the United States. But they want to conceal their activities. And it's certainly a concern, but the reality of how information flows today, it's easier to be decentralized and disorganized. If you lob ideas out there, without specifically calling, an individual to conduct violence in your name, but, ideas are powerful. So, folks will, know that they are well within their right to speak out, and they, also know that individuals that hear their words after they do speak out, may very well be motivated to violence, which achieves the end that they want, which is, to sow discord, terrorize communities. And in this case of the anti-institutionalist, or anti-government extremists, in their mind, those acts are shots to the whole of the government. And they hope that it will, in the aggregate, take the government down.
I'd like to maybe look into the drivers of this movement. And I refer to it as a movement, if only because it's a useful placeholder. It's a way to describe it, even though I think it is very, very distinct in its many ways here. But when we were speaking with Mr. Akkerbom of the AIVD in our last episode, he did highlight that in the case of the Netherlands, and he was discussing an extensive report that they've just put into the public about anti-institutional extremism, he described that there's a loss of faith in government and key institutions such as healthcare, for example, that's really driving this. And he discussed the importance of looking in the mirror to consider what role our own governments are playing in driving or are facilitating, not necessarily facilitating, but do they have a role to play in this particular movement emerging, this anti-institutional extremism? And if we look at the case of the U.S., what happens if we hold up that mirror?
I look, we're all here together. In the case of the U.S., it's a government of the people, by the people. So we all have a hand to play. We are constantly working to try to, in the words of our founders, perfect our union. So without question, the government has to be at all levels, at the local level, at the state level, and at the national level, has to be introspective about whether certain policies that we have maintained have contributed to an environment that proves fertile for certain types of violent extremists. That's absolutely the case. I think that the U.S. government is trying to do that. Again, at all levels, we're trying to be introspective. One area where we have committed significant focus, particularly here at the State Department, is our engagement with local leaders, because it is all of the extremists, all of the RIMVI actors come from some community. The spark that ignites their extremist fire is frequently born of some grievance that is felt personally or locally. So our engagement with local and municipal leaders who we consider to be at the front line is core to our strategy. That's something that we are doing in partnerships When I say we, I'm referring to the broader U.S. government, but in partnership with our colleagues at the Department of Homeland Security, which have kind of principal responsibility for these issues inside the U.S., as well as with law enforcement. But we're also applying that model abroad, making sure that we engage and support and properly resource local and municipal officials to build resilience in their communities. I mean, we do this, for example, through the organization Strong Cities Network. But we want to make sure that local officials know the signs, because the reality is, as I said, all of this, it starts small, and it grows large.
I think this is a really, really helpful area to focus on a little bit more. So particularly those international partnerships. And I know that you're very active in building and fostering those international partnerships. What are some of the key steps that your office is taking to not only help prevent that anti-institutional extremism, but to also work with partners, for example, those in Europe to help better understand and respond effectively to this phenomenon?
First and foremost, I think, and this is something you touched on earlier with respect to the absence of well-defined kind of, of actual definitions that are consistent. Setting a baseline, making sure that we, along with our partners, have a common understanding of this threat and its various components and manifestations is really important. If you don't know what you're looking at, it's very difficult to have a conversation about it or to devise policies that can effectively address the threat. So we have got to continue to work to define the threat and to understand it. Secondly, and again, I think we've made some strides there. We have more work to do, to include making sure that our terminology is as inclusive as possible. Again, we say RIMV, in our context, we're kind of really talking about white identity terrorism. But again, defining the threat, defining the problem, and then sharing information. We work with other governments at the national level, and where possible, we bring in subnational elements of governments. We want to make sure that we're sharing information. We need to make sure we're sharing information within our governments and then across governments, which again will go to help us understanding what this threat looks like. Once we're sharing information, we continue to put our heads together in multilateral environments as well as bilaterally to devise effective policies. And as I mentioned, one of the ways that we are working to do that is to facilitate connections and information exchanges at the local and municipal level. It has been really, I think, effective for municipal leaders who have experienced some of these attacks to share those experiences, kind of in a comprehensive way. What was happening in their communities and societies prior to an event, how they responded to an event, and then what they are doing in the aftermath, in the short term and the long term, to ensure that those types of tragic events don't happen. Nancy Roettering, the mayor of Highland Park, Illinois, where there was a several years ago a shooting at a 4th of July parade, has worked to kind of pull together this is what you do in the immediate aftermath. Here are phone numbers. Here is who you call. The type of preparation that a municipal leader has, this is not what they deal with on a daily basis. So figuring out just immediately how to respond. Then there are broader efforts to address and ensure that there are that radicalization isn't taking place in those communities, so that again we can prevent subsequent attacks. Making sure that municipal leaders and a variety of actors at the local level, police, social workers, educators, are engaging those who are vulnerable and looking for signs and doing everything they can to prevent. So helping to arrange and share expertise with respect to prevention is really, really critical. We also assist governments in their efforts to rehabilitate individuals, former extremists. And we've found, and governments and practitioners will tell you, some of the best advocates are the formers. They're able to speak the language. They know, they already walked the path that we're hopeful we can get some of these people to step off of. I would say really core is engagement in the broadest sense.
You just highlighted two important areas of focus here. So creating that common understanding with your foreign partners as well, and also shared terminology. Do you feel like with those foreign partners, we are moving more towards a common understanding of what this phenomenon is? And are we also moving closer to the shared kind of language that we can use to describe this?
I think we are. We're not totally there. We certainly have our work cut out, for us. I mean, we saw just a couple of weeks ago, look, things are always going to happen. What we can do is prepare ourselves. We can mitigate, or otherwise reduce the likelihood that catastrophic or, violent events are going to happen. We are all humans and we're dealing with humans, and the reality is there are probably going to be bad things that happen. But how we respond and how we, engage to prevent them, I think is what matters. But, look at a week and a half ago in Dublin, for example. There's, which is, and a community, by the way, that has, a lot of experience as an historical matter in dealing with, ethnic violence, and has processes in place. And so if this can happen there, where there has been a lot of thought over decades committed to building resilience and making sure that there's dialogue in communities, then we know that in places where, that haven't experienced the same, historical ethnic strife, it's going to be that much tougher. But, fortunately, I think, in Dublin and in Ireland, we are, I think that there are processes and experiences that will help them, navigate, even though kind of this most recent, round of violence, was related to anti-immigrant sentiments. Nonetheless, the tools are in place to help address some of those underlying concerns.
You also highlighted a very helpful area that I think is somewhat neglected in this space, and particularly that around strategic communication. So describing and explaining to the public or to other government actors how they can respond, or sharing your own experiences around that and steps that could be taken, for example. Is there a specific strategic communication or a stratcom approach that you think is helpful for communicating with the public around this particular issue?
I think that being honest about what we're facing is the single most important, component of any kind of public discourse and effort to address these concerns. I think that is why you have seen, in fact, I know that is why you have seen President Biden be so forthright about the domestic threat that we are facing. It was several, I think about maybe 8 weeks ago, 9 weeks ago, he made a comment again that as a domestic matter, the single largest threat that we are facing are from domestic violent extremists and white identity terrorists. So, I think being honest, about the problems that each of our societies is facing, will allow us to be able to engage various aspects of society that are necessary if we're going to craft policies and make sure that we have the type of dialogue that we need to have to address grievances and understand grievances and dispel myth as well. But if we don't talk about it, then we're behind the eight ball.
As we discussed earlier on in this conversation, we are living in an increasingly complicated world. We have the rise of AI. There's foreign influence. There's reducing faith in democracy. It's a busy and it's a complicated world out there right now. From your perspective, are there any particular issues that you think will affect anti-institutional sentiments or actors in a particularly acute way?
You know, we've spent a fair amount of time, I think, over the course of this conversation talking about individual actors and loose organizations. But I think we'd be remiss if we didn't also acknowledge that that state actors play a role here. I mean, this is certainly the case with the Russian Federation. The Kremlin's influence on Rimdi across Europe and in the United States is of significant concern to us. The Kremlin isn't really picking sides, except to pick all sides, to pit groups and individuals against one another, to water seeds that I would say are already there, right? What has happened is, the Russian government has, in a coordinated way, sought to exploit grievances that already exist within our communities. This goes back to my previous point about the importance of dialogue and our need to fully acknowledge some of these challenges that we have within our societies, because if we don't talk about them, the Kremlin will do it for us and do it in a way that ensures that there's chaos. That has been and continues to be a real concern. I mean, we've seen it in Europe over the past 2 years with respect to inflaming anti-immigrant sentiments related to Ukrainian refugees. They attack them, you know, coming and going. We are certainly concerned about the activity of the Kremlin, and indeed have committed money to understanding precisely what it is that the Kremlin is doing to exacerbate these and exploit these divisions that exist within our society in an effort to undermine Western liberal order.
I'd like to expand on one final point that you've highlighted here, and that's really the role of the online space here. Our lives are increasingly online, our communities are increasingly online, and I'd like to better understand from your perspective how the online space is affecting this phenomenon. And alongside that, what is the role of private sector actors, particularly some of those tech companies, in also addressing this issue?
We live online. There is not an aspect of any of our lives that isn't significantly impacted by the online environment. We get our news largely online. We shop online. We rely on online platforms to communicate with loved ones and friends and to forge new connections. So do these bad actors. This is the new, you know, public square. And just as we have policed the public square previously, we have to make sure that we have policies in place to address bad acts in the virtual public square as well. And there is a really significant role and responsibility that the private sector has. These are products and platforms that are used again by, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of people across the globe at any given moment. And these companies have terms of service. It is our view that they actually have to enforce those terms of service. The companies are adamant that they do not want their products and platforms used for ill, and as a result have rules that if you violate, then they will kick you off their platforms. It's, I think, critically important for those rules to be enforced. There are limitations, however, on the government's ability, and this varies from place to place. In the United States, for example, as I mentioned, our First Amendment tradition, the First Amendment restricts the ability of government to infringe on speech or to restrict expression. However, private actors are not under the same degree of restriction. So these platforms have the ability to enforce their terms of service and to make sure that their products aren't used to undermine the free societies and connections that they seek to build and forge in positive ways by having people use their products. And it's not just social media. It's not just those online platforms, but it's also the infrastructure, the service, internet service providers, the domain hosts, all have a responsibility to ensure that their services and products are not being exploited in a way to undermine the health and safety of society. And certainly, look, our counterparts in Europe, both at the European Union level as well as kind of domestically, have taken differing approaches approaches that are consistent with their legal traditions and frameworks, but that can go further than the United States can, given what our restrictions are. And we, as a general matter, are supportive of efforts to make sure that companies are held accountable and are implementing policies and processes that make their products safer for our communities. I think the companies have done a pretty decent job at pulling down content. They have worked collaboratively across platforms to make sure that violent content, particularly in real time with respect to, say, the live streaming of some horrific attack, that content is quickly taken down and unable to be spread across the internet. I think they've gotten a lot better at that, and there's still more work to do, but I want to acknowledge and applaud the companies for those efforts. Where there's still a lot more work to be done is everything that happens prior to that catastrophic event. It is the use of the platforms by extremists to promote violence and to radicalize individuals around the world. And again, I know that this is tricky. It's challenging, but we are up to the task. We've always been up to the task. So I very much urge those companies, and I know my counterparts in governments across the globe too are really looking to engage and figure out ways that we can work together to make sure that the online space is one that is safe, that we can freely walk across the virtual public square without being in fear.
Mr. Moss, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Joanna. I really appreciate you and ICCT's work and the opportunity to engage and all of the thought that your organization is putting into these issues. It's a meaningful contribution to this to the body of knowledge. And without strong civil society partners like ICCT, we would not be in the position we are to make progress on some really, really challenging issues. So thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Don't forget to hear our other episodes and to visit Perspectives on Terrorism and the ICCT website for more recent publications about the topic of anti-institutional extremism. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast episode was created by the International Center for Counterterrorism and is part of the series Anti-Institutional Extremism, Causes and Responses. You can find more episodes and information about our work on our website, www.icct.nl. This show is available on any major podcast service, so please subscribe and spread the word.